Give him a fill. Might be in this room. She's just busy.
Okay, good evening. I'll call to order the meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement for Tuesday, February 16, 2010. We don't yet have a full quorum, and I'm not quite sure if we will have a quorum for the full pension commission, but we will hear all the bills that's on the agenda tonight. If need be, we will act as a subcommittee of the full pensions commission, which means we could not take final action, but we will vote and make recommendations to the full commission and then act on those on Friday when we next meet. Now, if we do establish a full quorum, then obviously we will vote accordingly. Tonight on our agenda, we have a number of bills relating to individuals, and what we had decided to do was to basically set an evening meeting aside so that the affected legislators and their constituents would be able to make it in tonight. We've had sort of a longstanding policy on this commission that those constituents who have come in from the furthest distance should have priority and come early on the agenda because they have the longest way to go. Now, Senator Olson, your constituent is not going to be here tonight. Is that true?
No, I'm going to present
okay.
the bill.
Okay, good.
So I can be last.
Sure. You'll be last then. But Representative Poppy is here, and she is from Austin, and she does have a constituent here who apparently came the furthest. So we will start with number two on the agenda. And what we'll do is give the legislators, the authors of the bill, and their constituents an opportunity to address the Pensions Commission. And we have summaries here, which we'll then discuss, have the staff remind us what's in there, and then we'll have a discussion on the proposals before us. So, Representative Poppy, welcome to the Pensions Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and go ahead. Did you want to describe your constituents? You did receive a copy of the the summary that was written up by staff, I take it?
Yes.
Okay. Did you want to just kind of tell us just what the issue is before us and
yes,
have
please.
Your constituent address
yes.
the commission? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, commission members. We very much appreciate the opportunity to come tonight, and my constituent would like to share her story. I also have a memo that you are receiving that sort of highlights what we see as some of the key issues for her. One is that she is under unique circumstances coming before you, and that is because she had a change in classification in a job, and that job did not was not a different job, and it did not come from a different employer. We believe that that did not set a precedent. It is just that she received a different job classification, and one of the situations due to that job classification change was that she received a new retirement plan option. And that is why we're here tonight. Actually, on page two of the commission memo, the commission staff indicated that they have been unable to find any past similar specific refund repayment authorization legislation. So it is unique. It is just one person who is seeking this, and it will not set a precedent, and there won't be others who will be following. We also believe that she has an expectation to receive fair and equitable treatment, and that would be our second note there. She's been a college employee for a number of years, over 20 years. She's been a public employee since 1969. She has, at the time of her job classification change in September of 07, she actually was 59 years of age. She also had many years of work history, which included PERA and MSRS, and at the point in time when she had the job classification change, she was not given adequate information to make the choice regarding TRA, and we will discuss that a little bit more as well. And the other information that we'd bring before you is that there is a general standard of guideline that seems to be accepted among the retirement plans, and that would be that the accepted rule of thumb that if a person is over 55 years of age at the point in time when Mrs. Enfield received this job classification change, she was age 59, and it would be expected that she should have received counseling, which would have provided her the reason to expect to stay within the defined retirement plan and to not go to a defined contribution plan, the IRAP plan, and also because she was within 5 years of to retirement and had been in service for at least 20 years, that, again, she should be expected to have been given some responsible and reasonable benefit counseling to be able to determine that she should have stayed within a retirement plan and not gone to a contribution plan. So that is the case before you, and she is here tonight to be able to describe and answer questions as well.
Okay, Ms. Enfield, welcome to the Pension Commission. You'll need to identify yourself for the record, and then if you want to elaborate on Representative Poppe's comments, you may do so. Welcome to the Commission.
Hello, my name is Cindy Enfield, and thank you for allowing me to come to present tonight. I don't know if I have a whole lot to add, but when I was given the packet of information about my retirement choice, it was almost 3 months after I was actually promoted. And the packet was brought over by an HR person who had called and asked if I was going to be at my desk. And I said yes. She was in a different building. And she mentioned that she had to be in our building, so she had something to drop off for me. She brought over a packet of information. And then she gave me a sheet that said that I had to sign it to acknowledge receipt of the packet, which I did. And I asked for explanations on what this was, because I did not know that I was going to be switching plans. And even at that point, I was kind of confused about it. And then I asked her about the plans and, you know, what the circumstances were, and she said that she couldn't counsel me, but she did give me in the packet was some websites, and she encouraged me to maybe visit the websites or call to ask about, you know, the specifics of the plan, because she couldn't explain them to me.
Okay. The memo suggests that we ask MSRS and PERA, for their input.
Mr. Chairman.
Just a clarification. Maybe I wasn't listening close enough to Representative Poppe, but Ms. Enfield, in order to change plans, wouldn't you have to fill out a form or an application form saying that you agreed to, you wanted to go with a defined contribution plan?
Ms. Enfield. Okay. Or Mr. Martin.
Yeah. Members, I think I might be able to help at this point. By virtue of her promotion, Ms. Enfield became qualified for the unclassified employees plan. And if you remember from the last time the Pension Commission met, we were talking about the defaults in the unclassified plan. If you're eligible for the unclassified plan and you don't elect the MSRS plan, general plan coverage in an affirmative way, you get the IRAP plan by default. And that's what happened in this case.
So she was promoted into a different, which is good, but then all of a sudden, should put in a different plan. And apparently you're saying that they didn't tell you that you're going to be switching over into the unclassified plan.
In fact, they had put me in that by default before they brought me the packet, about almost 90 days before I got the packet. So I didn't know I was in the plan until 90 days later. And I guess you go into IRAP by default.
I guess Minsky is the one that would have the greatest interest in this one. Does any of the plans, including Minsky, want to weigh in on this one? Welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good evening. Gary Janikowski. I'm with Minsky. I'd like to maybe provide some background information just on what the process is. Ms. Enfield is correct. When She didn't actually get the paperwork until about 3 months after the effective date of her promotion. The reason for that is because this, the way the classification system works, the paperwork was submitted at that point, but it took about a good 2 or 3 months for it to work through the process. Then when it was ultimately approved, it's approved retroactive to the date that she actually became eligible for the plan in September of 2007. We do have a copy of the signed document she signed, that it's a notification of right to elect TRA. And very clearly on here, it does say that in order, one of the responsibilities, it says, I am responsible for taking the appropriate steps within the permitted time frame to make the election to TRA, and my election will be irrevocable. And that form was signed on December 3rd of 07. At the same time, what we ask our campus HR offices to do is to provide a brochure which explains the differences between TRA and IRAP and defined benefit and defined contribution programs. It's fairly general stuff, admittedly. But in addition to that, I did ask the campus what other programs. We do ask that they do set up training programs so that providers such as TIAA Cref, who does the administration for our plan, can visit campus, and MSRS or TRA as well. And the campus this morning sent me all of the information on the sessions that were held during that time period, and it looks like there were 3 or 4 different opportunities to either meet with an individual counselor to find out what the appropriate election might be for her, or we had group webinars as well. What we've been doing lately is, because we have about 700 people annually who become eligible for this, we run 2 or 3 times every year a webinar that is live, and included in the webinar are representatives from TIAA, CREF, and TRA, where they talk about what the differences are between defined benefit and defined contribution plans. And it's also an opportunity for participants to ask questions at the end of the webinar. As part of that training, it also, there's a component in there that TRA does cover that talks about, you know, if you've got other service with PERA or MSRS, it might be more appropriate for you to be in TRA. But we advise our campus HR people not to provide advice to participants because they're not qualified. All circumstances are unique and different, and the participant needs to decide him or herself which plan is the most appropriate for them within that 1 year time frame.
So does Minskew have a position or thought, you know, on this proposal?
Well, of course, we are concerned about the precedent that it might set, given that everything was done correctly according to the campus procedures. That would be one of the main things. And it does look like the campus did provide several opportunities for counseling, both on an individual basis as well as on a group webinar basis. So we're not supportive of it.
Sure. Ms. Enfield, Representative Poppy, anything further?
Yes, I would say I happen to be a Minskew employee myself. I happen to work at the same location, the same college as Mrs. Enfield. And I will just say that personally, I believe that an HR department is the source or the conduit to the source for information. And when Mrs. Enfield asked for additional information, and this would go 2 ways. One would be, here's some standard rule of thumb information. You're over 55 years of age. You've got more than 20 years of experience in the state system. You should stay with TRA or choose TRA. Mrs. Enfield is not a faculty member. I happen to be a faculty member at my college. But even TRA, what is called a teacher retirement account, may be a bit confusing to someone who is not a teacher, not a faculty member. But I think that there should be a reasonable expectation that you receive some standard rule of thumb guidelines that say, if you fall into one or both of these categories, this is what you should do. And to then say that there's a defined contribution plan versus a defined benefit plan, the fact that she had more than 20 years of experience and service in a defined benefit plan, she wasn't given the information to say, this is what you give up. And you know, 4 years, 5 years before you're going to retire, you're going to stop your basic retirement plan. I think that that just seems unreasonable for her, all of the burden to be on her, when we have an HR department who does provide information about wages, insurance, retirement. And for me, as an employee, I do my job well. I'm a counselor at the college. I do my job well. But I don't know the ins and outs of the HR department. I expect them to do their job well, and I would expect that as an employee, you go to the HR department, you have specific questions, you're asking for help. Just getting a list of websites or webinars is not adequate and reasonable to be able to expect as an employee of the state of Minnesota. And I would hope that that everyone would be able to give an employee the right amount of information to be able to, the beneficial counseling that someone should be able to be received in order to make the best decisions for themselves.
Representative Murphy.
I have a question for Mr. Janikowski. What were the dates on those webinar sites and the counselor site, or the opportunity to see a counselor?
Well, there was I myself did a presentation down at Riverland during one of their staff in-service days, and that happened on October 15th of 2008. And at that session, I did explain the differences between the two plans. In addition to that, there were webinars that were held in February of that year as well. It was after we usually run these just after the start of each semester, and we try to run them at different times. So in this particular case, we ran one, I believe it was on the 18th of February at noon, and the next one probably at 4 o'clock on the next day, because we realize people have differing schedules.
Okay. Mr. Chair, yeah, Mr. Janikowski, how are employees notified of those impending opportunities?
Mr. Janikowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we actually compile a list, as I indicated earlier, about 700 to 800 people are newly eligible every year. We get copies of those. We then put together an Excel spreadsheet of everyone who is newly eligible during the previous 12-month period, and we sort it by campus. We then send those lists to the campuses when we're going to offer the webinar so that we expect them, and that is exactly what happened in this case. We asked them to forward that invitation to the individuals on their campus who became newly eligible during that previous 12 months. And I do have documentation showing that such an invitation went out at Riverland and that the email was opened by Ms. Enfield.
Thank you. And Mr. Janikowski, one more question, and then I have one, Ms.
Sure.
Enfield. That first part that you gave us about that there's a lag time and then it's retroactive, is it usually 3 months after the 3 months time is up that they are presented with the materials?
Representative Murphy, that usually varies depending on the documentation that comes from the campus to support the promotion or the changed responsibilities. There tend to be a lot of these, and the staffing division, it depends on how the documentation comes in, and I'm sorry, I don't know the specifics as to why it took 3 months. I don't think it's that unusual.
Okay. And then the paper that is signed then says that Ms. Zenfield wants to be part of the Divine Contribution Plan.
No, the paper I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The paper that was signed simply says it's a notification of right to elect TRA. Everyone is defaulted and put into IRAP when they become eligible for our plan. Then the form that they're given is their notification of their right not to have IRAP, but to elect TRA. That's what the form is.
Okay. And Ms. Enfield, then you did not sign the form that said that you wanted to be in TRA. Is that correct?
I signed a form that was given to me that said that I needed to sign it to acknowledge that I received the packet of information. Okay. So that's what I thought I was doing when I was signing it.
Okay, and then if you didn't elect to go into TRA, I don't know how you elect then.
How do you get a form that tells you that?
You get another form? Mr. Jankowski?
Yes, Representative Murphy, I can certainly answer that. We don't, we usually require that the participants who want to elect TRA come into the HR office and ask for the form. If we put it out on the website, and they're, especially if they're new, we found that a lot of times they'll just sign anything put in front of them. So we want, and that's why we give them a notification of right to elect TRA form, so that they know that they have that right, and we ask for them to come in and get the form. And it's right on here. If they want to elect TRA, it says they must come into the HR office in order to sign that form to move to TRA.
And it says that on the form.
Yes.
Thank you. And Ms. Enfield, then you apparently did not do that. And so what did you do when you got all the information from IRAP and telling you the choices that you could make on which stocks and which mutual funds and all that?
I have a 403B with Tia Kreff, who is the administrator for the IRAP, so I was, you know, if I got any information from Tia Kreff, I was equating it to my 403B plan. So, you know, with stocks and that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin or someone tell me who made the decision that the default plan would be the defined contribution plan in the what do they call the unclassified?
Well, in this case, it's IRAP for the Minsky system, which is what she's in.
So is this law? Is it Minsky policy? Is it our policy?
It's the law.
We should probably hear also from TRA, what would the cost be to the service credit? Because Minsky, if this were to be approved, would have to pay for that cost. Mm-hmm. So is TRA able to weigh in on Mr. Thompson? Von Dable, welcome to the commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Luther Thompson representing TRA. The cost, the total actuarial cost by the 2.81 years of service with TRA is approximately $32,000. And the way the bill is drafted, the member would pay what she would have paid to TRA plus the 8.5% interest. The remaining part, which is about $7,600, the remaining part would be paid by the employer, Minsky, which is about $24,000. We've had discussions about this default. Particularly, you know, I have not talked to anyone who would have said that this would have been a reasonable economic choice to consciously elect IRAP with her age and length of service in the other funds. We've had discussions about this IRAP default, and particularly for people in technical colleges, it seems to be that anybody that had prior service in para, MSRS, and TRA, they should be strongly counseled to elect as soon as possible into the defined benefit plan. The problem with this election is that You get a notification 3 or 4 months after you've been reclassified, or in this case reclassified because we think it's rather unique. But for anybody going over there, they get the packet of material sometimes certainly after the date they're hired, sometime later during that year. It's 1 year they have to make an election. And you make an election in the nine months to go to IRAP. The first 9 months, to make an election to go to TRA, the defined benefit plan, you still lose the first 9 months because it's prospective only. That makes no sense whatsoever. And we've tried to have this discussion, and I think it's certainly an issue to probably discuss further. But you don't get credit for those months that you waited before you make the election, and that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Thompson, what does TRA do when they've lost a person like Ms. Enfield, and she's not asking to collect her TRA retirement, so she must be still working Do you do any recruiting?
Chairman Betzel, Representative Murphy, we never lost this particular person. She was a prior member of MSRS. And then they reclassified the position, and because it was reclassified, she then got to elect IRAP or TRA. She currently has no service with us, but she does have prior service with PARA and MSRS.
Oh, wow. That's a good clarification for me. And so maybe we should, Mr. Chair, have a clarification to that same question from MSRS.
And PERA?
All of a sudden, she's not in MSRS anymore.
Well, Mr. Chair, while he's coming to the table.
Sarah Pappas.
So when you have an employee that works PERA, MSRS, TRA, who pays their pension then? Is it, do all three pay into their pension? Uh-huh. Can they have combined years for their pension?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
The answer is yes. Mr. Bergstrom, welcome to the commission.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. When Ms. Enfield took the new job, she no longer was eligible for MSRS coverage, so we show her as a terminated employee. And at that point would not necessarily know where she was going or what options she had. What if Ms. Enfield was in TRA, she would have an option to repay a refund with us. She has roughly a little bit under 20 years of service, and she has 1 year and 6 months she could repay. So with the repayment or without the repayment, the benefit is $1,221. With the repayment, the benefit is $1,317, so there's a $96 difference. The cost to repay is $4,577. The actuarial cost of purchasing that time would be $17,452, so there's about a $12,800 difference. Also, if she was in TRA, she could repay PERA's refund, and that would be their issue. Under PERA, she has no money with them, so she would not be eligible for anything. If she repaid her PERA refund, she'd be eligible for $139 a month. The cost to repay that refund is $8,620, and the actual cost is $21,800 for a difference of $13,180. So if Ms. Enfield was in TRA, she could repay MSRS and PERA, but because she was in IRAP, they are not allowed to repay refunds to MSRS or PERA or TRA.
Okay.
Oh, maybe IRAP should.
Sarah Olson.
It's complicated. Well, I realize this seems like a complicated situation, but my overall impression of the situation is that we really don't want to set state employees up for sort of gotcha situations in something that doesn't otherwise make any sense for them to do, and that I tend to agree that there's some responsibility to at least point out to people when there's an obvious choice in one direction or another. I'm surprised. I mean, I understand we don't want to go so far as to say we're giving someone professional advice. You know, we don't want to do that as lawyers when we're legislators and so forth. But when we do have an HR department, I'd be surprised that wasn't part of the responsibility they would have, is at least pointing out those really obvious things. So that's one observation I would make. But the second thing I was wondering about is the cost to the Minsky system to make up this difference. Is that what they would have to pay? Is that what they would have been paying if she had been in?
Seems kind of high.
If she had been had elected the general plan, or why is it that the way the bill is written that they're paying that difference instead of the employee making up that loss like we usually see?
I don't know how
members the bill provides for the standard service credit purchase payment procedure that we use. In this case, it's the member pays what the member would have paid plus interest, okay, and the difference between the actuarial value of what the person would receive with and without that service credit is calculated. They subtract the member contribution and interest that's paid, and the balance then becomes, in this case, the responsibility of the party that we think caused the problem, which is Minsky, under the theory that the bill is using. It's much like buying fire insurance after the fire has started. There are insurance premium rates for prior to the fire. Once it's a dead certain risk, then it's a different proposition. And so we look at the actual liability, the actuarial liability, and that's what the prior service credit purchase is keyed on. So that's why it's a fairly large dollar amount after the fact.
Sarah Olson.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So in other words, it's one fund making another fund whole, sort of by doing that. But if she were expected to pay the whole thing, then there probably wouldn't be even any value in her having it, because it would be just that would be the total value then, right?
Mr. Martin.
This particular constituent has two problems. She has two sets of refunds that she did not repay. And you have to be a member of a defined benefit plan, one of the Minnesota defined benefit plans, in order to repay refunds to any of the other defined benefit plans. When she shifted to a defined contribution plan, IRAP, she lost that power. And so she has what she's losing in addition to future service credits, her Minsky unclassified employment time from 2009 or 2008, whenever her promotion occurred. She's also lost this opportunity to repay prior refunds, which affects her ability to utilize the Rule of 90 and about it also affects the amount of her retirement benefit. So we're talking about more than just the value of her current coverage or future coverage, but also this lost opportunity that really doesn't have a clear monetary mechanism associated with it.
Okay, Representative Murphy.
Ms. Enfield, Mr. Chair, Ms. Enfield, how did you become aware of the fact that you were switched out and that you couldn't pay back?
About a year ago, a year and 2 months ago, I wanted to buy back my prior, my other service. And so I contacted MSRS to see if they could give me a cost on it. I also did contact PERA for the same thing, and probably about a month after I had spoken with MSRS, I got a letter that stated that I could not purchase the other service for PERA and for because I wasn't a state employee, and they did tell me that on the phone also. About the second or third time I had talked to MSRS and had stated my interest in it, they said, well, you're not a state employee. You can't purchase it, past credit. I said, I am a state employee. And I told them where I worked. And I said, this is a Minsky institution. And they said, yes, but you're not MSRS. I said, you're not in the Minnesota State Retirement System. And I said, well, I work for a state institution. And they said, no, you may work for a state institution, but you're in IRAP, and IRAP is not a part of the Minnesota State Retirement System. So a year after the fact is when I found out.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Nelson or Mr. Stanton, do you have any ideas about what this would do to precedent?
Now, the memo suggests, and I don't know if this is true or not, it says the number of public pension plan employees by Minsky and shifting to Minsky IRAP coverage from a job reclassification to lateral transfer is likely to be relatively small. So, I mean, this is kind of a unique situation where somebody's reclassified, but we don't know. Mr. Stanton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I guess one thing I want to clarify, because there's sort of an impression that it's a real bad idea to go to IRAP. All employees get 1 year to choose between IRAP and TRA, and I sit down with just about every new employee at the faculty member at the state universities, and they do get good information from the administration, plus we put on seminars and I sit down one-on-one with them. And the vast majority, about 85%, take IRAP. And they take it because it better fits their lifestyle. They're not going to be in the same job all their life, and IRAP is a very portable position. So we would be very, very much opposed to IRAP not being the default. We also think that when people have a choice, they have a responsibility to inform themselves about these decisions. We make a real effort. The administration makes a real effort. And these, I mean, these are grown-up people. This is a big part of their personal economics, and they have a responsibility to make themselves aware of deadlines and make good choices. And there's lots of resources for people to make good choices. So I guess our position is we should expect people to adhere to deadlines, to inform themselves. They have a year to make a choice. I might also point out, you know, last session we, in terms of this making the choice, last session we gave people a second choice. And there was about 100 people, when they become tenured, to make a choice. And there was about 100 people that got that notice, got a letter that you have a second choice to make. Only 6 of them were interested in making the choice to go from IRAP to TRA. And none of those 6 have actually exercised. I mean, they had the calculation done, but none of the 6 have actually exercised the choice yet. They still have it till the end, you know, the year. The year isn't up yet. So I guess we strongly believe that IRAP should be the default, and we that should be left. And we also strongly believe that if the system is going to work, people have to take personal responsibility and educate themselves about this. And we do think that MNSCU has done a pretty good job. My only experience is with state universities, but we do get situations similar to what this one here. We have people who come that have worked a long time in a different, you know, MSRS or whatever, and are taking a faculty job, you know, in semi-retirement. Some of those take IRAP because they're, you know, they already are drawing another pension, and they only intend to be there a short period of time. So, those are our points of view.
Thanks. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you had talked to Ms. Enfield under her kind of fairly unique set of circumstances, can you see any reason why you would have counseled her to go into IRAP? I mean, it seems like from what the description we've had that in her particular circumstances that was really to her detriment and would have been much more to her advantage to go into the general pension plan. So, I mean, under these circumstances, you talked about what happens for people generally and on average, but is this a situation where you would have counseled her that going in IRAP was not in her best interest?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, usually if I come across a situation where if I discover they have a defined benefit, where if they're vested in a defined benefit plan already, I usually tell them, you better go see your defined benefit plan and have them calculate the cost of your buyback and do it. So that's what I would have done. But she's not, she belongs to me, not my union, so I wouldn't have been dealing with her.
Okay. Representative Poppy.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate Mr. Stanton's advocacy for people who are teachers and who happen to be in TRA and have our union members in the teachers union. Again, Mrs. Enfield is not a teacher, and she did not receive the same level of communication or counseling regarding the choice that was before her. Had she received that level, that intensity of information, I believe she would have made what would have been a clear-cut decision to choose TRA, to ask for an additional form or whatever it would have taken in order to do that and become a, remain in a retirement plan. And I think that, again, I we're not here to discuss the benefit of IRAP and whether or not it should be the default or not. We're really here to discuss this single employee and whether or not she received the beneficial counseling that would have meant she would have chosen TRA, then we wouldn't be before you. Because in 2007, in September of 2007, when she was given the job classification change, she got the upgrade, she got some more pay, she got a different union. She would have then gone into the retirement plan of TRA, and she would be looking forward to her retirement with the additional amounts, and she wouldn't be sitting here before you.
Okay. Members, since we have an administrative quorum, I think that the fairest thing to do would be say it would take four votes to recommend approval to the Pension Commission. So that seems is there anybody else who wants to be heard on this particular topic? We do have other agenda items we have to start getting to, so anybody else wants to be heard on this one? Is there a motion or any discussion by members? Representative Kahn.
So moved.
You okay. And we don't have any proposed amendments, do Mr. Martin? Just the bill. Okay. So Representative Kahn moves that the there's a Senate file. It's been introduced now. Senate file 2633, House file 2550 be recommended to the Pensions Commission for inclusion in the omnibus bill. So it's a recommendation. We'd have to vote on this again at our next meeting. Is there discussion on that motion? Senator Rosen.
So, Mr. Chair, this is not the final vote. This is a recommendation.
Yeah, because we don't have
discuss
a full,
it further.
Yeah. We don't have a full quorum, so we can't take final action tonight. So we are recommending to the full. We're acting as a subcommittee.
Okay.
So we will send this over to the full commission at our next meeting. It should go fairly quickly, when we do that. But but since we don't have a full quorum here, we'll have to act as a subcommittee at this stage. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so for clarification on Senator Rosen's question, I think what we're wondering is, are you going to hear additional testimony?
No. No. It's not my intention to take additional testimony. We'll take up the recommendations of the subcommittee. Obviously, if members want to discuss them further, we can do that. But it's my intention to, whatever's favorably recommended, we will consider that. Things that are not recommended, I don't think we're going to be taking those up, because if it's not recommended to the full commission, we shouldn't be spending any time in the full commission on that. So only those items that get a favorable recommendation, it's my intention to, put them on the agenda for our next meeting. Okay. Senator Pappas, since we have an administrative quorum, it'll take four votes. And what we're doing is recommending to the full pension commission. As I say, if favorably recommended, we're not going to bring the authors back or the constituents back. We'll just vote next time we have a commission meeting. So Representative Kahn has moved that Senate File 2633, House File 2550 be recommended to the Pensions Commission for inclusion in the omnibus bill. So discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No.
The chair's in doubt. Those in favor, please raise your hands. 1, 2, 3. Those opposed? Okay. Motion does not prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, commission members.
Thank you. Okay. Number one on the agenda is Senate File 1374. I haven't seen Senator Metzen. Is House File 1569, Representative Hansen, or either one here? Is there anybody who's here on item number one? This is regarding the, Kinney. Anybody here on that one? Apparently not. Okay, we will go to number three. Senator Pariseau just came in. Senator Pariseau, Senate File 2394, authorizing a late disability application in certain cases. Senator Pariseau, welcome to the Pension Commission.
Good evening.
And do you have your constituent here?
I Mark May.
Okay.
Is my constituent.
So. Okay. Please come on up to the witness table.
I have to carry the load, I think. But.
Senator Parasol, what we'll do is we have a brief write-up already, which you've probably received, and hopefully your constituent has seen it too. Maybe you want to just give us a brief description about the issue you're bringing before the Pension Commission. If Mr. May wishes to testify, he may do so. And then we'll certainly we'll hear from staff and certainly from the funds. Senator Parasol, did you have any comments on the issue before us?
Well, the issue before, I'm sorry. Mr. May has some interesting fill-in material that I didn't know before, but I do have the bill before me here, and it's a retroactive disability benefit application issue. And it happens that not all the materials got presented at the time. There was a deadline for it, and so he was denied. But I'd like to have him plead the case because he has everything in his head.
Yeah, Mr. May, welcome to the Pensions Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mark May.
Okay, go ahead.
In 2006, I was let go from my job for an injury that I incurred in 1996.
You can bring it up.
Put in for my pension disability, Social Security disability, unemployment. I put in for everything that I was told, you know, that I thought was available for me. The pension, the first time I put it in, was denied. So I called to appeal it, and they let me come appeal it. That was denied. So I contacted my attorney. I was in a work comp battle at the time, and I contacted him, and he contacted PERA and told them what had happened. And at the time that I put in for it, the president of my pension was the gentleman who terminated me. So at both times it was denied. So my lawyer, who was in charge of it at that time, sent it in front of the Supreme Court. From what I heard from my lawyer, they sent it back to PERA, and then they asked, and last I had heard, he had filed, and they were waiting for more medical, because one of the doctors had changed to a different clinic, and the clinic wouldn't release the information until he released the rights, or whatever, to let it be put out. And the last I had heard, they got the medical information and sent it to PRA, and I never received anything stating that I had to refile. If I would have gotten information, I would have refiled, believe me.
Okay. Mr. May, you know, I'm reading through the staff memo, and it indicates that your application for disability was denied in July of 2006. That you appealed to the PERA Board of Trustees, which then rejected your appeal in September of 2006. Your attorney, Gary Manka, appealed to the Minnesota Court of Appeals in November of 2006, but then your attorney withdrew the appeal and indicated that you were going to ask for reconsideration by the PERA Board because it had an incomplete record. But after the appeal was dropped to the Court of Appeals, there was never then a request for reconsideration to the PERA Board. Is that a correct statement?
Not that I know. What I had been told is that they wanted medical information, and we were waiting for him to get the medical information.
But
I never got any paperwork to appeal.
Okay. But you apparently had an appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which was then withdrawn. Is that correct?
What my lawyer told me is they told him to give it back to PERA and let them have another go at it. What my lawyer said is they wanted him to refile it with them, and then he told me he was getting all the medical information because there's a number of doctors involved in it. And one doctor was, like I said, changed clinics, and they wouldn't release his information, so he had to find the clinic he had gone to. And the very last thing I heard is that they had gotten all the medical information, and I heard nothing after that. Okay. I didn't hear if I was supposed to, if I was supposed to file an appeal, or if anyone was. I didn't hear anything.
Well, if an appeal was filed with the Court of Appeals, you know, they wouldn't have given advice saying, well, why don't you, I mean, they're going to hear the case or not. And if your lawyer would have withdrawn the appeal, you know, that obviously would have stopped any action in the Court of Appeals. So, I mean, if you're not quite sure, I'm not. But the information we've got was that there was an appeal filed to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and it was withdrawn. So,
what I have been told is that the first two times I filed for it, well, when I went in to talk to them for a verbal appeal, they gave me 2 days to come in. And I couldn't get a hold of my lawyer to come in at that time. So when I went in there, the gentleman who had terminated me was there and wasn't supposed to be there. Shouldn't have been there, from what I understood.
Okay.
So,
Ms. Vanek, do you have any additional information you want to provide to us? Please identify yourself for the record.
Deadline issue. Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. Again, Mr. May applied for disability. There were no doctors who submitted medical information that supported a definition of total and permanent disability. Upon review of the medical reports by our consultants, the doctors at the Department of Health, they advised us to deny the benefit. We did. He appealed to the board. And I just want to clarify that I did check the minutes of the September 2006 board meeting. I see that Mr. May's case was added at a last minute. The gentleman from the city of Richfield, for whom he worked, was the president of the board at the time, but our minutes clearly show that he excused himself and left the room during the discussion on Mr. May's case. So he was not involved in the discussion and the vote on whether or not to support his appeal of the staff decision. The case was then appealed to the Court of Appeals. Our record shows that his attorney withdrew the appeal. There's indication by an affidavit by his attorney in the file that said our attorney from the Attorney General's office agreed to allow it to be reconsidered before the board, and then the record ends until July of 2008, where we received a request from Mr. May for disability application paperwork. We submitted that. We sent that out to him on July 15th. If he would have submitted the application at that time, he would have been within the time frame to apply again. But now it is beyond the three-year time frame, and so he's missed his opportunity.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. May, did the attorney, Mr. Manka, was he continuing to represent you throughout this period of time?
Mr. May.
Yes. yes, he was. And this application that was supposed to be sent to me, I never got. It never came to my house. I don't know if they have the wrong address or if they sent it to my attorney, but I never received it because I filled out everything I had to fill out. I've been fighting this for 3 years.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. May, it seems like, and it's really hard, and I hate to make a public record of something criticizing anyone because he isn't here to know, you know, what the other side of the story is, and there may very well be an explanation for this, but, you know, on the surface at least, it looks like the attorney requested that the appeal be withdrawn with the anticipation that a later action was going to be taken and would know that some later action had to be taken to follow up on this, and yet no later action apparently was taken by one or the other of you or both. You know, if he was still representing you during that period of time, presumably he would have been acting, you know, for you in making sure that this got done. So I don't know who dropped the ball in this circumstance, but it seems like someone did, and that there would have been, someone should have known that there was a subsequent action that was going to have to be taken here after that appeal withdrawal, that didn't happen.
Sarah Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to draw attention to by the members of page 2, line 216. An application for a disability benefit under paragraph A, which was the obvious the stance under which it was going to happen, must be filed on or before January 1, 2011. And it doesn't have any more information than that about whether it's ever moot at a certain point. So let it still be alive.
Yeah. Well, Senator Parasol, this is the bill that's being proposed, and of course, if the bill were to be passed, that would give Mr. May until that time period to file a new application, because right now the time has elapsed and he can't do it. This just opens the window for him to do that for a couple more months. So your bill is basically, that's the key part of the bill, is to give him additional time to do that. But the information that's been given to us was that he's already, it was initially turned down by the board. It was appealed to the Court of Appeals, but the appeal was withdrawn because there was going to be a request for reconsideration by the board, which was then not filed. So, we're trying to understand the procedural history here. So, Sarah Pappas.
And, Mr. Chairman, there's two things. That it appears that his request was denied because there wasn't enough, that he didn't have the medical reports that he needed to have. So I assume that those are now available. But also I've noticed on the memo that he is the recipient of Social Security disability, which I think is a pretty high standard to be able to get that. I don't know the difference between Social Security disability and PERA disability. Maybe Ms. Vanek could enlighten me.
I don't know. Ms. Vanek, do you happen to know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we have similar definitions, but we evaluate independently. Social Security tends to take into consideration vocational factors, educational background. That is not part of our test.
Yeah.
We did have the sufficient number of medical reports submitted by Mr. May.
Oh, you did.
It's just that the doctors did not. We asked the treating physician, in your definition, in your position as the treating physician, do you believe this person meets our total and permanent test? And neither of his doctor's reports supported that he met the definition. And just, I think it feeds into the total situation that was going on in Para at the time. We were having a lot of police and fire occupational disabilities. There was a lot of press about that.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. May's attorney, in contacting us about the appeal, indicated in a letter to us that the fact that he couldn't do his job at the city was clear enough reason to qualify him for disability. And in our general plan, that is not the test. It's not just that you can't do your current job. It's that you can't do any type of work. I also would ask the commission to consider that he has been off the job since June of 2006. Our law requires evidence that he met the PERM total test before he left public employment. To attempt to prove that at this point in time would be a real challenge, I believe.
And the test for Social Security disability, as well as the statutory test for total and permanent disability, is at the bottom of page 2 of the memo, so you can see the two different definitions. Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question about the lawyer part, because I guess maybe being a lawyer, that really bothers me, is what happened there. Is there anything else? I mean, was there ever any future contact from the lawyer? Did the relationship with the lawyer end then at some point, or did the lawyer originally try to get back and file this later but it had missed the deadline, or what happened that the lawyer is no longer in the picture?
Mr. May.
I've been in contact with my lawyer for 3 years. I've been talking to him on and off about this my work comp case, and then every time I go to the doctor, that's denied. But I've been in contact with him all the time, and nothing was ever. I've never heard anything that that we didn't get our appeal or our paperwork in, or, you know, that we had a date set, a deadline anymore, since we had already appealed it, or I had appealed it twice, and it had gone in front of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I didn't go to the Supreme Court. Went to the Court of Appeals.
The
Court of Appeals.
Yeah. Okay. And when I talked to my lawyer the first time, when it went to the Court of Appeals, he said that he had contacted PERA and talked to their legal, the head of their legal department, and that what he had said was that it was done illegally, that he shouldn't have been in the building, shouldn't have been there for the meeting, knowing that I was going to be there, and just getting up and excusing himself was not legal. Just to say I have to excuse myself because of conflict of interest and walk out the door, according to the PERA lawyer, that this is secondhand through my lawyer, that it was not legal for him to be there that time. But we were told to get all the paperwork together, all our medical records, there's probably six or seven doctors that have medical or more medical information on this. So that's what we're doing. The last I had heard is that we finally got a hold of the last doctor and sent in all the paperwork. And then this is where I got a call from his assistant saying that they wanted me down here. That was the last I'd heard.
But I think the question that Sarah Olson's got, I've got, is the fact that, again, from the record that what we know about is that there was an appeal filed with the Court of Appeals. It wasn't pursued. It was dismissed. It was withdrawn for the purpose of pursuing a reconsideration by PERA, but then nothing was ever done with PERA to get the matter reconsidered. So somewhere the ball was dropped or something happened, and we just don't know that. And, you know, it sounds like you're not quite sure what happened either. Okay. Okay. All right, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Parisso, we're trying to work with you and Mr. May here, but I think it's been summarized well. I mean, the situation from where we sit is that you had an appeal in place. You withdrew the appeal. You said you were going to go pursue this again with PERA, reconsideration with PERA. PERA is indicating that that did not happen. And so, and Mr. May, you're out of time. And so I'm struggling to figure out what the commission,
would any
what our
commission member
are
have
here.
Any problems if I laid the bill over?
Okay.
Sarah Olson?
Mr. Chair, if we're going to lay the bill over, I would really suggest to Mr. May that he go back and ask his lawyer for some evidence that he submitted these papers that he told you he submitted and where they went, because from what we're hearing from PERA, that never happened.
I don't know what submitting it over, would it be better if he was here? Is it going to be... I don't understand
Mr. May, I don't anticipate we're going to have much time to hear any more constituent bills this session. If you prefer a vote, we can take a vote. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, on that note, you asked, I think, if it was the will of the commission to decide. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard anything here this evening on this case, on this situation that makes me feel compelled to lay this over for further information. I think that it's been laid out in a relatively straightforward fashion.
Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Pappas?
I just wanted to say one thing. It seems to me when PERA has already denied it twice, and that I don't know if a third time through is going to help anymore. So... if I thought that there was compelling new evidence that you were prepared to present to PERA that you didn't present the first two go-rounds, then maybe I think that the deadline issue then is the only issue. But I think it's also the issue of you've already been through this a couple times. you know, almost pursued it in court. I don't know why that was withdrawn. But it just doesn't seem like it's going to work for you.
The first two times I put in the paperwork from the doctors, I went and contacted two of the doctor's offices or whatever, or three, I don't even know. But then during the whole 3 years, there's another doctor involved in it. And so I don't know. I mean, as far
it
as
sounds
the
like
paper,
doctor shopping.
Huh? No, I mean, it was, oh, I don't know.
Ms. Vanek, does Mr. May get any PERA benefits? He's seeking disability, but obviously he might be entitled to something else here.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I didn't. Given his.
Early retirement?
Given his birth date, he would be eligible this spring for reduced retirement in the plan.
Thank you. Okay.
Move to put it on the table.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves to lay the bill on the table. Just not debatable. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. We laid on the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Paruso. Mr. May? Okay. The next item, number four, Representative Peterson. Let's see. This is Senate. Well, it's an old. It's a reviser's number, but it was previously heard by this commission in 2007. It's number 072768. This is a service credit for uncredited prior teaching service. And again, we did hear this previously, as I recall. Representative Peterson, welcome back before the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we are back because at the last meeting, we were requested to look for some additional information, which we did, and we also compiled a bit even more than was requested. And so we're back here again to ask for credit for Sherry Ruttman. Sherry Ruttman is a constituent in my area. She is also a teacher, has been a teacher for many years, almost ready for retirement, a teacher in White Bear Lake, St. Paul, Minnesota, Minneapolis, in early childhood, and I might add a wonderful teacher and quite an entrepreneur, actually, on many new ideas for early childhood. And so I'm very proud to be here and help her at least explain why she should be getting the retirement that she needed. She's going to tell her story first.
Well, Representative Pearson, she already did. And when we heard the bill before, we said there wasn't any – we didn't have enough evidence that she'd actually worked for the St. Paul Public Schools. We asked that she go back and see if she could find any documentation or anything on it. And presumably, if there was, to submit it to the St. Paul, not to us, but to the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. So has anything been submitted in paperwork to that association? We're not in a position to evaluate any paperwork. They would have to do that. Have you submitted anything to them?
It was my understanding, actually, that it was this body that was looking for the information.
Well, we're going to ask the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association what they think about it. If they haven't seen anything, they're not going to be in a position to evaluate whatever paperwork you've got.
I have some prepared statements.
No, well, but again, you were before this commission before. We heard the issue before. We gave you directions to get some information and give it to the pension fund. So the question that I've got for you is, have you provided anything to the pension fund? Because we're not, you know, they have to know what the documentation you've got to show that you work for the St. Paul schools.
We do have some additional information that perhaps would be valuable for you, and I don't know it might be valuable also for the St. Paul Pension Fund. We didn't realize that that's a direction we needed to go. We can certainly do that.
If it has not been provided to them, it has to be.
Okay.
We're not in a position, because I need to know what they think, and we're not going to take a vote on something that they haven't even seen. That isn't how the process works. So why don't we set this aside, give Mr. Kepler an opportunity to look at the papers for the first time, and we'll circle back to you. If he hasn't seen it, you got to play fair. Okay.
This is fine. When you say circle back, is that circle
back
tonight?
I'll keep this on the agenda. I want Mr. Kepler an opportunity to look at those papers.
Great. Thank you.
So, we'll see if you've got something later on in the evening that he wants to talk about. But if he says we're not in a position to discuss it, the Pension Commission isn't going to spend any time on it tonight. Okay. Next item, number 5, Senate File 2463, House File 2651, Senator Rummel, Representative McFarlane. This is Social Security leveling option for single life annuity. Welcome to the Pension Commission.
Go ahead.
And do you have a constituent here, too?
No, he's not able to be here, but we did submit his testimony.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I believe this is the first time both Senator Rummel and I have appeared before your committee, and you have more experience in this than we do, but we hope that you'll take our issue into consideration. We have sent you the testimony from our constituent, and I think you can read it for yourself. I feel that this is very much like the case that Representative Pocky gave, where a constituent was maybe misinformed or misled regarding the Social Security leveling option. And I guess I want to give you time to look at that. Would you like to?
Now, and is your constituent also seen the staff memo that we have on this?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay, please proceed. Go ahead.
I think in his simple math, it shows that he has received the $200 a month, and then he has paid it back at $272 a month over that time, and is hoping that we can at least have a stopping point for his payments or have it capped at some point.
Go ahead. Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, and thank you for hearing this. I spoke to Mr. Ziemer last night, and in his explanation to me, I guess there were two things that first he felt that when he made this decision, the information he was given was inadequate. So that was his first issue. And I realized that in the summary, he did sign an affidavit saying he had read it and he understood what he was getting into, but he claims he really didn't understand it. And then the second thing is, just goes back to what Representative McFarland said, and I called up the Pension Commission yesterday, and I guess I don't understand, and this is my ignorance about these things, the way the mathematics is done. I thought I had a wonderful conversation with Mr. Burke, but in the end, I couldn't quite reconcile the mathematics that our constituent is calculating and Mr. Burke's explanation. And I think that would help a lot if we could better understanding.
Yeah. I think Ms. Vanek can probably explain it better. but in the simplest way to describe it is that for whatever reason, he chose to have front-loaded a higher, it looks like higher retirement payments early on, and now apparently he's getting less of them, but he's not tied into Social Security. And, as the memo says, that would have been an odd selection, but for whatever reason, that's the one he chose. But Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members,
This pre-62 supplemental payment that's provided in our statute is something you'll be hearing from me about in the next couple of years. It creates a lot of problems. But essentially, individuals are counseled on the amount of additional income they can receive until they turn 62, and then are advised that their benefit will be reduced by $100 a month going forward, plus any post-retirement adjustments they received on that supplemental income, and that it is a permanent reduction. And the way it is structured into the financing of our plan is that some people don't live long enough to pay it back, and the survivors are not obligated to make the repayment, and some people live longer than it takes to pay us back. In his case, he selected the additional payment of a little over $62 a month, both on his basic pension, which is non-Social Security covered time, and his police and fire pension, also non-Social Security covered time. So he took the extra $62 in some sense each month till he turned 62, and then we reduced his pension by $100 a month. To take back the extra $62 and to recover what he received in additional income by $37 and some cents each month for the rest of his life. That's how it works. And he is looking at the reduction of a full $100 a month and counting that as the recovery, but actually it was just taking away the supplement and then taking a little more to get the recovery. There are a lot of individuals who call us on this issue. They don't recall being counseled on it. I see that he was in a pre-retirement planning workshop in my other life at PARA. I gave a lot of those workshops. It was one I gave. I can't say for certain, but I know I emphasize to people that if you think you are going to live longer than 10 years, don't take this option because you're going to pay us back more than you ever got. We have on record, I had my data guy put the numbers together quickly so that you would know the impact of this. If you do it for one, you'll have others coming forward. We have just under 2,000 people in the basic plan who took it and are over the age of 62, and another 6 who are currently receiving it have yet to have the reduction. Our coordinated plan, we have just over 6,300 people who took it and have already realized the reduction, another 1,000 people who are still receiving it. In our police and fire plan, we had 676 people who took the option and now who are now over 62, so have realized the reduction, and another 237 yet to get to 62. In our correctional plan, the numbers are small. But the bottom line here is that there are a lot of people similarly situated to this constituent who could come forward and say, I've already paid back the additional income I received, so I want my benefit reinstated to the higher amount again. It means to him about $103 a month in additional income. It means to PARA about $11,800 in additional income we need, or additional money we need to set aside to cover his remaining lifetime. So I guess in relative terms, that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you think about the number of other people who could come forward and ask for the same treatment, we are concerned about the precedent.
Any questions? Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair, it sounds like Ms. Vanek is pointing out the
I think they're opposed.
The precedent that this could set. I'm wondering, are there other, I mean, have we had similar requests like this before?
Well, I think Ms. Vanek is saying that she's going to be before us probably with other people that, you know, made this decision to get an accelerated pension early on and suddenly realize, after a few years, realize it's not going to work out very well for us. Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, what I have on the agenda for study is the value that this adds, which we don't believe is a lot. We have noted that there used to be well over 60% of the retirees back in the late 80s who took the option, both in the coordinated and police and fire plan. It is now about 18% of retirees who choose this, because I think we're getting the message across that you will likely pay us back longer than the money that you would have received through the supplement. So we're going to be proposing either eliminating it or doing something. We do have people who contact us routinely when they get to 62 and we send them a letter, your benefit's going down this month, who say, I don't remember, but they obviously haven't pursued it with you.
Oh, sure. Okay. Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out or get a point of clarification. You said $103 a month. I think he's taking from two different PERA accounts, so his is doubled that amount, right?
No, Mr. Chair, that's the two. It's roughly $51, a little over $51 a month in each of the two benefits that he's receiving. And we've been trying to work with him and showing him how it's calculated, but he still insists it's the full $100, and it's not the full $100. It's the difference between $100 and the supplemental amount he received. That's how you calculate the recovery piece.
Okay. Anybody else here on this issue? Any questions, any comments? What do you want to do?
I'm going to put it on the table.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves that we table Senate File 2463, House File 2651. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rummel, Representative Farley. Okay, so Representative Atkins, LCPR 09070, purchase of a prior service credit for a period of omitted deductions, Invergrove Heights public employee. Representative Atkins, welcome to the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Good evening. Let me start by saying this one sets no new precedent. The facts are not in dispute, and the parties are in agreement.
Okay.
That's always a good beginning,
sure.
Isn't it?
Welcome.
Well, and as we've had issues before where somebody it wasn't the employee's fault, but they were put into the wrong fund, and we've usually not held that against the employee. We do want to know what the costs are. The staff memo does raise the one question that Ms. Dockendorf probably needs to discuss. There's been a 24-year delay between the time when she wasn't given the proper credit because she wasn't properly reported and now, and obviously when you're getting closer to retirement. But Ms. Dockendorf, welcome to the Pension Commission. Did you want to tell us about your situation?
Thank you all for your time. Why did I wait so long? Is that?
Yes.
Actually, when I started, and it occurred to me there was a problem, I didn't really think about retirement then. And about 5 years ago, I did attempt to have it corrected, and then I was notified it was too late. It was about 5 years ago that I realized I'm getting old, and I have to start thinking about retirement. So that was the delay, is that I didn't face the fact that I'm getting older than I really thought I was. And the business manager actually approached me and told me, maybe you should pursue this. And that was just recently. Because when I was denied 5 years ago, then I just gave up. And then the business manager said, well, maybe you could pursue another angle. And that was just recently.
Okay. Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, para director. We did consult with the school district, and actually 5 years ago they admitted that she should have been reported earlier, but because it was too late under our statute of limitations, nothing further was done. We did follow up, however, when the bill was introduced, and we learned that she first qualified under our monthly earnings test in February of 1986. So I've explained to her that we can't go all the way back to the earlier 85 date, but it is clear that she would have been eligible in February of 86, so there are months of service that were missed. We calculated the cost to her at contributions plus interest, if paid by July 1st, to be $464.74. Hmm. The total actuarial cost is $4,244.88, so the school district would be responsible for the $3,780.14.
And is there anybody here from the Invergrove Heights District? Just to make sure. Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, and the school district has agreed to pay that $3,700.
I have been verbally told that. Yes, has Mr. Armstead talked to you?
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I haven't personally talked to anyone, but when my staff worked with them, they did provide the information. Said yes, this was our oversight. So that's as much as I know.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Murphy,
if we receive information in writing that everybody is Representative Atkins said in agreement, and the school district is willing to pay. And Ms. Dockendorf is willing to pay. Then I move inclusion or recommendation to include it in the.
Okay. And Representative Atkins, it would help us, or Ms. Vanek, it would help us if we did get something from the school district indicating that they're in agreement to this. What's the process that we have is that, as you've heard, we'll be voting on it as a full commission when we meet on Friday, but we're still putting together the full pension bill, so that's still about another 2 weeks away. So we do have some time, not a lot of time, but we've got some time before we actually wrap up the bill and start sending it through the House GovOps and the Senate GovOps Committee. So discussion. Representative Murphy moves that LCPR 09070 be included in the omnibus, recommended to the Pension Commission for inclusion in the omnibus pension bill. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails.
Chair and members, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Then, let's see, Senator Olson, your constituent is not here, but we do have LCPR 10-018. I'm sorry? Yeah. Oh, let me ask one more question. Did we get anybody here on item number one, Senator Metzen and Representative Hansen on the is it McKinney? McKinney?
Yes.
Nobody else, nobody's here on that one. Okay. Well, Senator Olson, since your constituent isn't here, you can present it, I guess, from your. If you want to present from your spot, you can do that. Or there. It doesn't matter to me. So,
shows up the same
Mr. Chair,
tape.
Whatever you'd like, but I'm here
okay.
Now. So
you're there.
Okay. Now I know what it feels like to be in the witness stand.
Welcome to the
or table,
commission.
Witness table. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to, first of all, acknowledge responsibility from my office for not having Mr. Dunshee here to testify in person. We had some mix-up in communication, and he's about 5 hours away. And so by the time that he knew that he would have had to be here today, it just wasn't possible for him, and that's really my office's fault. But I had a long conversation with him prior to this meeting, and hopefully you can look at me and see Mr. Dunshee in terms of the ability to present his story fairly and answer any questions that you might have. But if some real critical things do come up and it would make a difference to your vote on this issue one way or another, then I'd appreciate, you know, the opportunity to lay it over and bring him here at some point. I realize that the timing might not allow that to happen this year, and that's why he asked me to go ahead, because he's the school district is hoping to have a decision from him about retiring by March 1st, and so he really would like to know, you know, what might happen with this. But in any event, I'd just like to bring your attention back to March of 2005, March 21st of 2005, which was really a tragic day for anyone who lived in northern Minnesota, but particularly those people who lived and worked on the Red Lake Indian Reservation. That was the day when Jeffrey Weiss killed 9 people, his grandparents, a teacher, and other school members, and then eventually was killed himself. And 5 other individuals were very seriously injured. So this was really a very sad way to have attention brought to Red Lake, and something that was in the national news, and a real terrible tragedy. Unfortunately, since that time, and this isn't the only example of this. I will say that I have talked to other school teachers on other issues, not this issue, but other issues where our state law really hasn't worked very well in treating people the way I think we would like them to be treated following a tragedy like this. Because they happen to be teaching or working in a school where something like this happened, there have been some consequences, negative consequences to them and their employment that have resulted simply because we've applied the rules that normally apply, and they don't work very well for people because of situations that really weren't intended to deal with this kind of a tragedy. And so sort of like when the bridge fell down and we took a global approach to dealing with private citizens, I guess I'm asking that we look at what's fair for a state employee where those rules are really not working, where he's being penalized because he happened to be the school principal of the school where this happened. And this is how he's being penalized. Following this incident, like many of the other school staff, he was so traumatized that he really wasn't able to return to work right away. Well, actually, the school was closed for a period of time. But there was a huge amount of stress involved in having spent those hours in the school where there was fear for your life and for a lot of other students, people being killed either right in front of you or, in some cases, you know, in a room next door, and a lot of really traumatic things happening through gunfire and what was coming over the loudspeaker and people hiding. And it was just a terrible ordeal. And as a result of that ordeal, Mr. Dungey ended up suffering a heart attack about a month later and has since been diagnosed and continues to this day to be suffering the impact of post-traumatic stress disorder. After roughly a year of taking disability benefits because he wasn't able to return to work, his condition improved to the point where he was able to return to a part-time job working within the school, but his doctor continued to tell him under no circumstances can you go back to the position you were doing before. So thinking it was better to be doing some work than no work, he went back for about two-thirds employment for that second year, and then ultimately did end up taking his job back as a principal for the last couple of years, but really doesn't feel that he is, even yet today, able to do the job the way he would like to be doing it, and so feels that he should be retiring this year rather than staying an extra few years, which he would have probably done if this incident hadn't happened. So where the problem arises is that because of the high five rule, apparently when he was taking disability, he wasn't eligible to be making those contributions to his retirement and making up those differences. And so what he's asking for is the high five rule doesn't just apply to your under normal salary, doesn't just apply to your normal high five or your highest 5 years. It applies to your highest 5 consecutive years. He had this very, very unique and unusual circumstance that happened because of his employment and where he was that took out, right during those last years of his service, took out the years of contribution, meaning he kind of has to start over again to build that high five and would have to work 3 more years to bring himself back into the position he would have been in if this event hadn't happened. So he's asking to just have the high 5 years calculated from his highest 5 years, which would basically then put him in the same position he would have been if there hadn't been this interruption of this period of time as a result of the shooting at Red Lake. And I would also just like to note, and I read through very carefully the memo that we received from Mr. Burke. This is Mr. Burke's memo. And I guess I would just have to say, well, I'm not sure that I can say that anything about it is inaccurate. There might be some impressions about it that I think are maybe different than or maybe not as fair as they would seem to me. For example, where it talks about justification for the request, when I read that, I got the impression that somehow Mr. Dungey was actually benefiting from the fact that the shooting had happened, that he was coming out ahead from the standpoint of how much money he receives from different directions, and that's certainly not true. I mean, he did receive a disability benefit, yes, but that disability benefit did not even completely make up for his lost income for that period of time, which he would have been receiving if he hadn't been working. And so, therefore, you know, he's still losing money in addition for that period of time compared to what he would have been doing if he had been working. And so I'm not even quite sure why that is even related unless I'm missing something. But based on what Mr. Dunshy told me, that disability benefit was entitled to make up for the fact that he was disabled because of a work-related event and he wasn't able to work, but it certainly doesn't make up for the loss that he has in terms of how his pension is calculated, unless there's other information I'm not aware of. In terms of individual responsibility, well, certainly wasn't anything that he did that caused this event to happen, this very, very traumatic and stressful event. And he is diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which is something that certainly does interfere, and that's a medical diagnosis with a person's ability to be comparing all these potential different benefits and different ways to go and the effect that that may or may not have on his pension. I think really what he was dealing with that time was trying to deal with the medical ramifications and all the people who he was responsible for who were dealing with all the fallout of this. And the impact on him and his retirement was probably the last thing that he was thinking about. I don't think that other people are going to be in this same circumstance. I mean, it's hard. They would have to have been in their last years of work and then have lost the benefit of high five. And I don't see that there's anybody else, you know, who's really similarly situated. There may be some different other people who've had other kinds of negative impacts. And the one that specifically comes to mind is that some of these teachers had very limited workers' comp benefits in terms of providing them the kind of mental health treatment that they needed because they didn't have an actual physical injury. Our current workers' comp rules don't really deal with this situation very well, and that, to me, is a separate issue that maybe we should be taking up separately through a different legislative body, but not penalizing Mr. Dunshy because there are these other issues, potentially. I guess the last thing I would say, I can tell you with regard to number 10, I asked Mr. Dunshy about any other compensation. He did not receive any other compensation from other directions other than a $50,000 payment from the crime victims that he received initially before he got the disability money, but once he got long-term disability money, that money had to be repaid to the disability fund. So once again, that was a wash, and so there wasn't some additional insurance or anything on top of this. And so I guess that pretty much in a nutshell, to the extent that I can think of, the information that I can think of that you would want to know. But if I have, if you have any questions, I'll certainly try to answer them.
Well, and Senator Olson, yeah, thank you. The obviously, we can't set aside the murders in that school from Mr. Dungy's life, but it seems to me the salient facts that we have here are the fact that, you know, he was on track towards retirement. He had a heart attack, which could have happened anyway. I mean, obviously, he was under a lot of stress, but, you know, he might have had a heart attack or a stroke or something like that, that maybe some medical condition. But, and so he wanted medical leave, and then he started drawing disability, and then he came back to full-time employment. Now, that's an odd track, but, you know, that's the one that happened in his situation. And so I guess I'm interested, we obviously, the memo suggests obviously we, you know, find out from TRA if they've got any information. Was he counseled as to his decision to start drawing disability benefits, how that was going to affect his opportunity later to come back and work, affect his high five? Does TRA have any information to provide on on this, Mr. Thompson?
Thank you, Chairman. Luther Thompson, representing TRA. I think, you know, the issue here is, are these circumstances so unique as not to set a precedent? And the issue about it happening in the high five, is that so unique as not to set a precedent? The issue, he was on the first year on leave, and he fully paid for his service and salary credit. When somebody comes in and applies for disability, we don't really question, you know, the issue about are you disabled or not. We ask for the medical evaluation, and in order to get the disability approved, you have to be unable to engage in substantial gainful activity, and that condition has to exist for more than a year. The definition of substantial gainful activity is usually something, meaning you can't engage in a full-time position of some sort. We don't have an occupational disability, so it doesn't mean that you wouldn't be able to do something other than teaching or being a principal or a superintendent. Unlike for Social Security, they have a limit. If you exceed 14,000, if you're going to make more than 14,000 approximately, you're not considered disabled. They consider that substantial gainful activity. So, you know, he's on the medical leave, but then he does apply for disability. He comes back. He's on disability for a year, and nothing happens then. The next year he returns to work. He actually gets a full year of service credit because the number of days that he works qualify for the full year, the 170-day rule. So he gets a full year of service credit for that year, but he doesn't get the full salary because he can't get salary credit for his disability payments. So there is a cost to TRA. It's not in the bill, but TRA will bear the cost of this. The difference is between the full required reserves to pay for his benefit under the current high five rule, the consecutive 5 years, versus allowing the member to select any 5 years, and that's about $17,000. And nothing in this bill provides for that payment. And that would have to be borne by TRA. And as you already know, TRA is in a difficult financial situation. So the actual cost is $17,300. But there is nothing in the bill that says somebody other than TRA would bear that cost. So the issue is whether the uniqueness, I can't speak to that. We certainly have many disabilitants. Not all of them are disabled in the high five, but there is always the issue about once you start allowing disabilitants to pay or get service credit or get a waiver for the high five, the consecutive high five, I think that's problematic.
Is there a way, Mr. Thompson, that are you saying that if Mr. Dunshee were to pay the $17,000, that would take care of, you know, from your fund standpoint, what you're looking for?
That would make TRA whole. Then the issue is the Pension Commission, I assume, would make the determination that these circumstances are so unique as they would not set a precedent or be very unlikely to be repeated in the future.
What's your thoughts on that, Mr. Thompson? I would assume that in most cases when somebody applies for disability retirement, they usually mean it. And but I don't know. Do people get disability retirement and then come back and start continue working again after that?
Mr. Chairman, we always encourage people to return to work if they can, yeah, because they can earn up to what they're, including their disability, they can earn up to what their salary was prior to the disability. So we think it's good public policy to encourage people to go back to work and to be engaged as much as possible.
But then what's the fund's position then on people who do that? They're on disability, they go back to work, they can do the job, but they're trying to get their high five in. I mean, should they then have to repay the fund if they want to keep building up their high fund?
Well, if, Mr. Chairman, if they go back to work and are able to be, you know, fully employable, I mean, working full-time, we don't think that they should be getting disability payments. And, in fact, right. if after they become disabled and are receiving a disability, if we receive information that the person is fully qualified or the condition no longer exists, we will take them off disability.
And, of course, the issue here is that Mr. Dunshi doesn't feel or can't work for five more years to build his high five again because he's got the interrupted.
And Mr. Chairman, he has had different counseling sessions with TRA. He's 63 years old. We have the counselors have discussed with him the possibility of him working another year or two. It is my understanding that he either feels or has chosen not to pursue that.
Sure. Okay. And obviously, if there's information that Senator Olson has or can get, we can certainly keep it open to figure that out. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Thompson, how long has Mr. Dunshi been in TRA?
Mr. Thompson.
How many years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, 22 years.
Okay, and
Representative Murphy.
Representative Olson or Mr. Thompson, what years does he want to count for his high five?
Sir Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I couldn't tell you the exact which years they are, but basically what he's saying is that he wants to be able to count the highest 5 years he would have had from the time of his retirement back, and it would basically just be all of the years excluding those 2 years, the 5 years from this point backwards, 5 years excluding those 2 years after the Red Lake shooting. So it's basically, I guess that would be like the last 7 years minus those 2 years. And, Mr. Chair, could I add a couple of more comments? I did talk to Mr. Dunshi because no one had raised this issue with him before, but I did tell him that sometimes, if there's a cost associated with something, that there are some cases where, the employer pays it, or sometimes where the person, the pension beneficiary is required to pay that cost and what his position would be on that. And he would certainly appreciate the option to pay the cost if that were the determining factor. Mm-hmm. So that was something that I did raise with him, and that was his response. It might be that the school would decide they want, that would be up to them, but the school could decide that they wanted to pay that cost. As I said, everyone recognizes the tragedy of this situation and that it was a very unique circumstance where people are put in this position because they happen to be in a location that was very unusual. And generally, I think whether it's the school board or whether it's, what we should try to do at the state where we can, try to not have people further victimized financially because of the circumstances that they were in on this day. And to the extent that we could give them the opportunity to try to make this right for Mr. Dunshi, as I said, he was very honest with me in saying I have this post-traumatic stress disorder. The school board's been very patient with me in letting me come back, but I really don't feel that my concentration level, which is typical for this diagnosis, is what it should be. I'd really like to do the right thing for all concerned. So,
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, I have actually two questions. What would have been his contribution level for those 5 years? What would he be? What is the amount? Do you have that?
Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Senator Rosen, perhaps Mr. Thompson can answer that. I don't know exactly, but I do know that the benefit difference for him, if we make this adjustment for him, the benefit difference will be between $200 and $300 a month is what he thought. That's about the amount of money that he'll be losing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I think those figures might have been based upon an earlier estimate when he came in and wanted to get the full salary and full service credit, I mean the full salary and the full service credit for the year he was on disability. If we look at it just as any five, the five highest years rather than the five consecutive years, the cost of $17,300 would have increased his benefit by $117 a month. There was a discussion earlier on where he was given cost estimates of what it would take to pay or to make him whole during that consecutive high five, and he felt that was not an acceptable alternative.
Mr. Chair. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I guess my question is, are there some other teachers, faculty members, that are going to be suffering or have the same situation out of this, the Red Lake tragedy? I mean, are we setting the precedent for that?
Yeah. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, the only issue that has been brought to my attention with regard to teachers from Red Lake, as I said, has been an issue related to how their unemployment benefits are calculated and impacted, where they have we have rules about only taking into consideration either physical injuries or in terms of providing the counseling or benefits about whether someone can work or not. They don't really apply very well in this situation in allowing those teachers to get the either compensation if they're no longer able to work or counseling help past a certain point in time. But I'm not aware of anyone else who's ever brought forward a similar kind of retirement issue.
Mr. Chair, though, is this something that we could be opening the door for, Mr. Luther or Mr. Thompson? Mr. Luther Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, you need to apologize. I was called that many, many times the other day by Representative Pawlowski. But having said that, there's always the possibility the door would be open. But the way this has been framed, you would have to be disabled only in your high five. Now, there are many reasons for being disabled, as Senator Betzel said. I mean, you could suffer a heart attack or a stroke. You would certainly, many people choose or try to go back to work. I don't know what the number is, but, I wouldn't limit it to the Red Lake area. I mean, it would be any disabilitant for whatever reason. And I can't speak to where one disabilitant would be, it's more, they're all tragic in some way, that, you would try to limit it to only this particular one.
Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can understand in principle that you could say, just like when the I-35 bridge tragedy happened, that we could say that any time somebody has an injury and has limits on what their recovery is, it's a tragedy for that person. And I think I actually said that on the floor when we talked about this. But we also recognize that this was a really unique circumstance that as a state, we felt people should not be further victimized, and we should step up as a state and try to do something to help them out where we could. And I guess that's the level of tragedy, at least for the people in this community, how they viewed this, the level of this tragedy.
Well, if it was the state paying the bills, that'd be one thing, but we're talking about the pension fund paying the bills, and it's easier to spend somebody else's money. I think one of the unanswered questions, and it might matter to the commission as to the thought of, is Mr. Dunshi in a position, is he willing to pay the actuarial cost to the fund? That might be, significant, and we don't know the answer to that. So, you may have to have an opportunity to discuss that with him and, have him and Mr. Thompson talk or something like that and just find out. I think that's at least one thing that we probably might want to know. It might affect, what members want to do, but other discussion. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, I've been really struggling with this since I first read the memo. On the one hand, when I first approached the subject, I had some grave reservations about this case, and from the standpoint of utilizing the pension fund, any pension fund, frankly, as a means to seek to address some other related conditions, stress, physical, psychological, unfortunate circumstances, and using the pension fund as a mechanism to sort of make that situation right. That makes me very, very apprehensive. On the flip side, I visited the Red Lake School when we toured with the bonding committee. I'll never forget it. It was very difficult, and it was a happy day when I was there. But it was a really somber sort of experience, and I think was reflective of the extreme situation that community and that district has been faced with. And in hearing your testimony tonight, I think your analogy to the Minneapolis bridge collapse is perhaps a good analogy. And I would just echo the chair's request that we get some further information from Mr. Dunchy, and if there's, with all those reservations that I noted, I'm willing to at least try to entertain some resolution.
Sarah Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think to the extent that this commission is willing to at least consider something that would try to find some way to not see that Mr. Dunchy's pension is penalized in a way that we can try to find where the pension isn't taking the cost hit on this. I mean, I appreciate that very much on his behalf, and I'm sure that he would appreciate the opportunity to try to work through these numbers and see if there's any way to reach a resolution. Perhaps he can contribute. Maybe the school would be willing to help. I know he'd appreciate that.
Representative Kahn.
The thing that still bothers me about it is the thing on page 3 and 11. Where the fact was that what he took had higher value than any other option. So I'm.
Sister, you move this way.
Is the question on? So that we're not even into an issue of false counseling.
Mr. Chair.
Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I agree with you. When I read that too, that's what I was talking about when I talked about the same kind of point sort of being made under number one. It was almost like it's implying that somehow he's coming out ahead by this event having happened, and that simply isn't the case. You know, the disability benefit really can't be weighed against the loss of the pension benefits to me, because the disability benefit was intended to replace salary that he was losing, and he didn't get that salary plus the disability benefit plus this pension. The disability benefit just partially made up for the salary that he lost. So I guess I just don't really think that I agree with having it represented that way. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me to represent it that way.
Well, as I say, I can lay it over until you can get back to us and provide the information. I don't know if it's necessary. I think we're informed of what the issue is. Obviously, if Mr. Dunchy wants to come down here, we'll give him the opportunity to talk to the commission. But I think that, you know, I think we know what the issues are here. So
okay.
You have to use your discretion there. But so, Sarah Olson, I'll lay it over. I'll wait till you contact the pension staff and let us know if you've got a resolution. If it's as early as this Friday, we'll put it on this Friday. If not, but you know the clock is running, so.
Thank you. I appreciate that
okay,
very much, Mr. Chair.
So this will be laid over for hopeful
consideration at a later date. Let me ask one more time. Senator Metzen, Hansen here on the item number one. I don't see anybody. The last item, Representative Thiessen left me a voicemail message last night saying he did not wish to have this issue heard tonight, the Faribault Fire issue. Is there anybody here on that one? Okay, let's go back then to number four. Mr. Kepler and Representative Peterson. Mr. Kepler, have you had a chance to look at the paperwork, and are you in a position to make any informed discussion on that? If not, you know, we'll lay it over until you have an opportunity to do so. Mr. Kepler.
Mr. Chairman, members, Phil Kepler, St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. Ms. Ruppman has gone to some effort and applied considerable diligence in finding old paperwork relevant to this period. She was able to find W-2 wage and tax statements from the period, which was what we inquired of the district, whether they had any on file. The district reported to us that they could not find a W-2 for Sherry Ruppman, which is what we would look for as proof that she was considered their employee before we would even move to the other criteria, whether the position required a license from the Department of Education and whether the person possessed one, whether this person was under the substantial control of the superintendent and the school board in their work activities. She has provided photocopies of W-2 statements from the relevant period, but the W-2 statements, one is a sample from another district, and district number 624. The other W-2 statement has lists as the employer of the West 7th Street Family Center on 395 Superior in St. Paul, Minnesota, with a taxpayer ID number of 41124-2815. Now, we actually did go to the effort to try and scare up former finance director and the current finance director for the school district, but both of those folks were indisposed this evening, so they weren't able to tell us whether that is the employer taxpayer ID. I think it's for the most part, it's a simple matter of resolving who that is. But I think you've really got two issues before you here. Who is the entity that reported the W-2, reported this person as their employee, one, and then under whose direction and control was this person working, who had the authority to hire, fire, determine hours and conditions of work and pay. And I think that there is a little more information that's needed to make a dispositive determination on this, and I don't know whether you want to follow up by rescheduling this at a hearing. Oh, we do have a federal taxpayer ID number. It doesn't correspond to the one that's on the W-2 that's been provided on these forms. That taxpayer ID number for the school district is 41090131, and this is 41124-2815. So these are two different entities for tax reporting purposes, and this is not any W-2 issued by the school district would have the school district's taxpayer IDs. This is not it.
So you're not in a position, it sounds like, to tell us one way or the other whether you can make a definitive decision tonight as to whether or not she was employed by the St. Paul School District.
As of this point, it's clear to me that no additional evidence, no compelling evidence has been presented that this person was, in fact, a district employee, and the circumstances might be that someone could construe that, but at this point, we don't have the information that would warrant a conclusion that she was the district's employee and that contributions were due. It's still indeterminate.
What I'm thinking about doing is just laying it over again, giving the school district. What's that? Okay. Yeah. Ms. Gilbert, did you want to provide information?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have had our HR department check twice now, last time in 2007, and again, they went through the records and looked up the employment records of Ms. Ruttman. And our records indicate that we first hired her as a long-term sub position in August of 1981. And a year later, then she was offered a full-time position. She was not our employee during the period in question. And generally, when the district does work with a lot of different entities, However, when we have an employee that we place specifically for district business, we maintain their employment records and have general control over them, regardless of the location.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the question is, and we've all probably, at least several of us have concluded, according to some of the statute language, that St. Paul probably did get a grant, but it's pretty specific in this grant that they had to keep those monies in a separate fund or coordinate with a nonprofit corporation. And so my guess is that they probably formed a nonprofit corporation for the purpose of having the early childhood programs, which would make sense. It's a quality council on education. They came through the Department of Ed. The grants were given to the districts, and then the districts could form, you know, as any grants, they could form a corporation or keep it in a separate fund, separate from their other funds. So I guess the only question we are left with is whether she was under the supervision of the district, and that would be whether her direct employer or the person who supervised her, this I can't remember. Anyway, whoever supervised her was also an employee of the nonprofit or was an employee of the school district. It seems to me that's the one issue we haven't determined yet.
Well, but I think that, again, we looked at this before, and I think the feeling is that she had to be an employee of the St. Paul School District in order for the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund to have any responsibility prior to August 31st, 1981, and so far there is no evidence that she was employed by the St. Paul School District. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, yes, that's a fair statement. Okay.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say for the record that I'm familiar with the West 7th Street Family Center. I think my children at a very young age were involved there. It was a kind of a precursor for community education, ECFE. But it does sound to me like there is confusion about, on Ms. Rentman's part, on the role of a nonprofit organization that the school district contracts with, where you don't have kind of the same benefits that you would if you're an employee of the school district, and which is the reason why a lot of the counties and the school districts do that, because it's cheaper for them to contract with nonprofits, but it definitely is a disadvantage for the employees, in this case with pension benefits. Often they don't offer health benefits either, nonprofits. So.
Okay. Well, what do you want to do? I can lay it over if you want to keep working on it, or I can take a vote, or do something. Any thoughts?
I'm not sure I see that there's any information that we're lacking.
Okay.
I've looked at it twice before. Mm-hmm. You know, the issue is still always the same, that despite what she thought she was doing, she was not an employee of the St. Paul School District.
Okay. Table.
Mr. Chair, I move it. Place this bill on the table.
Okay. Move to place 072668 on the table. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Okay, thank you. Anybody else has got anything before the commission tonight? I think we're done with the agenda.
I have a favor.
Reverend Murphy.
I have a favor.
Yes.
There's something in my district on Friday night.
Okay.
And so if we could start at 9:30 or even 9:45 on
okay.
Friday.
I think we can do that. 9:30?
Start earlier, you say?
Why can't we start earlier?
9:30?
Yeah, 9.
The sooner the better as far as I'm concerned. I have to go home after.
Yeah, we have long days.
I don't know if I can make it here by 9, but I can be here by 9:30.
I would really appreciate it.
9:30.
Okay.
Well, we will send out a
update.
An update, and we'll meet at 9:30. So,
because I didn't get home till like 6:10 the other night.
Well, but we went later. But okay. Anything else?
And that's fine.
If not, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
See you Friday.
Let's just start at 8:30 without you, Don.
Yes, we could, but we won't.
Don,
I would never suggest.